Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're going to be taking a deep dive into the book of Joshua. Picking up where we left off, the Israelites are about to enter the promised land. You guys have already heard how God chose them, you know, redeemed them from Egypt, gave them the law at Sinai, all that. And now, finally, they're ready to claim this land flowing with milk and honey, right? But as we're about to discover, taking possession of that land, it's going to be a lot more complicated than just showing up, pitching a tent, and calling it a day.
Right. Yeah. It's not as simple as it might seem at first glance. You know, the book of Joshua, I think a lot of people just view it as a straightforward conquest narrative. But it's really so much more than that. There's ancient geopolitics, military strategy, and even some really, really challenging ethical questions that we have to grapple with.
Okay. So before we get into those battles, those campaigns, all that exciting stuff, can you maybe give us a quick overview of the historical and political landscape? Like, what was Canaan like at this time?
Yeah, sure. So picture this. Canaan, it wasn't like a unified nation state or anything like that. More like a patchwork of, you know, independent city states, each one ruled by its own king. And these kings, they were constantly like jostling for power, often at odds with one another. It was kind of a messy situation to begin with, right? And to add to the intrigue, we have these amazing ancient documents called the El Amarna Letters.
The El Amarna Letters.
Yeah. They're basically complaints from these Canaanite rulers to Egypt, which was, you know, kind of their overlord at the time. And they're basically saying, hey, things are getting out of control here. We're dealing with all sorts of rebellions and uprisings, and we need help.
So basically, you've got these Canaanite kings dealing with all this internal strife, all these power struggles. And then suddenly you have the Israelites show up on their doorstep, this massive group of people fresh from escaping Egypt, no less. I can only imagine how threatened they must have felt.
Oh, absolutely. And there's another piece to this puzzle, too, that makes things even more interesting. Ancient texts from around this time, they mention a group called the Habiru.
The Habiru.
Yeah. And these guys were like kind of mercenary soldiers, warriors for hire, known for their military prowess, you know, their ability to move quickly and strike hard. And their description, it sounds a lot like how outsiders might have viewed the Israelites entering Canaan, right? Mm-hmm. So you can see how the Canaanites might have perceived the Israelites as a similar threat, given the Habiru's reputation.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you've got a land that's already divided. You've got rulers who are on edge. And then you have this arrival of the Israelites, led by Joshua, whose very name, by the way, means Yahweh is salvation. Talk about pressure. It's like the stage is set for an epic showdown. And while the book of Joshua sometimes makes it seem like this conquest was swift and decisive, it actually took about 7 years for the Israelites to establish a firm foothold, right?
Yeah, that's a really crucial detail that often gets overlooked. You know, the conquest, it wasn't like a blitzkrieg or anything. It was a gradual process of, you know, taking territory, securing control, consolidating their gains. And their main camp at Gilgal down in the Jordan Valley, it served as this strategic base for their campaigns.
So it's more like a series of carefully planned operations rather than one sudden takeover. Huh?
Exactly. And this detail about the camp at Gilgal, it also helps us understand why the Book of Judges, which comes after Joshua, doesn't contradict the story of the conquest, right? Judges, it focuses more on the challenges and the setbacks that the Israelites face during the settlement process, whereas Joshua, it kind of zooms out and gives us the big picture of the overall victory.
So it's two sides of the same coin, right?
Yeah.
Offering a more complete picture of what was happening. Okay, but now let's get to the part that I think a lot of people struggle with. You know, this command to wipe out the Canaanites, it's one of those things that, you know, people read and they're just kind of like, wait a minute, how does this fit with a loving God? And I think we need to tread carefully here, provide some context, because it's not an easy topic to grapple with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even by ancient standards, the Canaanite culture, it was deeply corrupt. Their practices included things like child sacrifice, ritual prostitution, extreme social injustice, just horrific stuff that was abhorrent to God.
I get that. I do. But it's still tough.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of destroying entire people groups, it's just hard to wrap my head around. Like, yeah. Wasn't there any other way?
Well, it's important to remember, like, this judgment, it didn't just come out of nowhere, right? If you think back to Genesis, when God first promised the land to Abraham, he said that the sin of the Amorites is not yet full. And so that suggests there was a timeline, a period of divine patience that eventually, you know, ran out. And think about the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Those cities, they were destroyed because of their wickedness. So this idea of a land becoming so polluted that it like vomits out its inhabitants, as Leviticus puts it, it wasn't unique to the Canaanites. It was a principle that God applied in other situations too.
Okay, that helps to see the bigger picture a little bit.
Yeah.
But what was God's purpose in commanding the Israelites to do this?
I think it comes down to this idea of spiritual purity and preserving the Israelites' faithfulness to God. God wanted to set them apart, to create a holy nation that would reflect his character to the world. And remember, even the Israelites themselves, when they turned away from God, they faced severe consequences. Exile, judgment, all those things.
Right. So it wasn't about targeting a specific group of people, but about upholding a standard of holiness that applied to everyone, insider or outsider.
Exactly. And it's important to understand this concept of harem, which is often translated as, you know, devoted to destruction. But it's not about random violence or anything like that. It's about a complete and irreversible separation from everything that's considered unholy, you know, almost like hitting a reset button for a society that had gone way off track.
That's a helpful analogy. Okay, so it was a drastic measure.
Yeah.
But one intended to purify the land, create a space for God's people to flourish. But I think it's also important to remember that even within this context of harem, individuals who recognized God, who sought refuge, they were spared, right? Like Rahab, the prostitute who helped the Israelite spies. She and her family were saved because they acknowledged God's power and put their trust in him.
Exactly. And that's a really important point. God's judgment, it wasn't indiscriminate. There was room for mercy. There was room for redemption. Even in the midst of this really difficult and complex situation, God's heart is always ultimately for restoration, you know, for reconciliation. But sometimes drastic measures are necessary to create a new beginning.
Okay, so we've tackled this moral dilemma of the conquest. But now let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the military highlights. Can you walk us through some of the key campaigns, you know, and their strategic importance?
Yeah, for sure. So the first big event is the crossing of the Jordan River. I mean, it's incredible, right? The Israelites, they're standing on the banks of this rushing river, and God parts the waters just like he did at the Red Sea, and they walk across on dry ground. What a powerful reminder of God's faithfulness, his power to overcome any obstacle.
It's almost like he's saying, look, I did this for your ancestors, and I'm doing it again for you. I'm with you every step of the way.
Totally. And then comes the fall of Jericho. This is the first major city that the Israelites conquer. It's strategically located, you know, guarding the entrance to the hill country. So taking Jericho, it was a huge victory for them.
Okay, but Jericho, I mean, that story has always fascinated me. You know, the walls crumbling down at the sound of trumpets. Come on, is there any archaeological evidence to support that account?
Well, that's where it gets really interesting. Archaeologists have uncovered evidence of a massive destruction at Jericho right around the time that the Israelites would have been there. Fallen walls, burned layers, the whole city seems to have been violently destroyed.
Wow, so there's actual physical evidence that seems to support the biblical account.
Yeah. And while we can't say for sure whether trumpets literally caused the walls to collapse, the evidence definitely points to a sudden and dramatic destruction. I mean, it's just a reminder that the Bible isn't just a collection of myths and legends. You know, it's rooted in history.
That's amazing. Okay, so they've conquered Jericho. They're making progress. Things are looking good. But I'm guessing it wasn't all smooth sailing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they must have faced some setbacks along the way.
You're absolutely right. They did face setbacks, and one of the most significant was at a place called Ai. They initially suffered defeat there, and it was all because of one man's sin. Achan, driven by greed, he took some of the plunder from Jericho, which was strictly forbidden, and his actions had devastating consequences for the entire community.
It's a reminder that our choices have consequences, right? Not just for ourselves, but for those around us.
Right. A powerful reminder of that ripple effect. But the good news is that the Israelites, they learned from their mistake, they repented, and they eventually conquered Ai using a very clever strategy. You know, it involved an ambush, feigned retreat, pretty impressive stuff. And it shows that even in defeat, there's always a chance to turn things around.
There's always hope.
Of course. God's grace is always available. But even in victory, you know, they made some missteps. Remember how Joshua made a treaty with the Gibeonites without consulting God?
Oh, yeah, that was a classic. The Gibeonites, those crafty Canaanites who tricked the Israelites into making a peace agreement by pretending to be from a faraway land.
Exactly. And Joshua, you know, without seeking God's guidance, he fell for their trick.
It shows that even the greatest leaders, right, they can make mistakes. Especially when they rely on their own wisdom instead of seeking God's.
So true. But here's the thing. Even though the treaty with the Gibeonites was a mistake, God used it for his purposes. It actually ended up helping the Israelites gain control of a large portion of southern Canaan.
So even our mistakes, sometimes they can be redeemed.
Absolutely. God can take our messes and turn them into something beautiful. And that brings us to the Southern Campaign. Five powerful Canaanite kings, including the King of Jerusalem, they formed an alliance to attack the Gibeonites and, by extension, the Israelites.
Five kings against one. Talk about a David and Goliath situation.
Right. But the Israelites, with God's help, they were victorious. They routed their enemies. They secured a vast territory. It was a major turning point in the conquest. And from there, the Israelites continued their campaign northward, culminating in the defeat of Hazor, which was the largest and most powerful city in the region at that time. Taking Hazor, it was like breaking the back of Canaanite resistance.
So from the Jordan River to the fall of Hazor, it's this epic story of faith, courage, perseverance. The Israelites, led by Joshua, they had done it. They had conquered the land God had promised them.
It's an incredible story, for sure. But the story doesn't end there, right? Next comes the dividing of the spoils, the land itself. And that might sound less exciting than, you know, battles and conquests and all that, but trust me, it's just as important.
Okay, now I'm intrigued. We'll have to save that part for our next deep dive. But until then, listeners, keep exploring, keep asking questions, and we'll see you back here soon to continue our journey through the book of Joshua. Welcome back to our deep dives into the book of Joshua. Okay, so last time we left off with the Israelites having conquered the promised land. But the story, it doesn't end there. Now they have to actually divide up the land, right? The spoils of war, I guess you could say. And I'll be honest, when I first read these chapters, I kind of thought, okay, this is where it gets a little dry, right? Lots of names, boundaries, all that. But I was so wrong.
Yeah, I get it. It's easy to just kind of skim over those sections thinking it's just, you know, administrative details. But there's always a deeper meaning, right? These chapters are about so much more than just like drawing lines on a map.
Yep.
We're talking about God's faithfulness and fulfilling his promises. We're talking about inheritance. And we even get some hints of what's to come in Israel's future.
Okay, now you've got my attention. Tell me more about this deeper meaning behind dividing the land. What should we be paying attention to as we read these chapters?
Well, first off, just imagine yourself as one of the Israelites, right? You've just crossed the Jordan. You've been wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, living in tents, surviving on manna. And now you're finally stepping into this land, a land flowing with milk and honey, a place to call home. It's the fulfillment of a promise that God made to Abraham generations ago.
I can only imagine the emotion, you know. A sense of relief, maybe even disbelief. Like, is this really happening?
Exactly. And then as the land is being divided up, each tribe receives its portion, its inheritance, a tangible sign of God's unwavering commitment to his people. It's not just about the land itself. It's about God keeping his promises, even if it takes centuries.
That's a good reminder for us today, right? That God's timing isn't always our timing, but he never forgets his promises. But okay, did every tribe get an equal share? Was there any, you know, drama involved in this division?
Well, not every tribe received the same amount of land. The allocation was based on several factors: the size of the tribe, the strategic importance of the territory, you know, even the geography of the land. And yeah, there was definitely some drama. The tribe of Joseph, for example, through his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, they actually received a double portion, fulfilling a blessing that Jacob had given his grandsons.
So even in this seemingly orderly process of dividing up the land, you've got family history, you've got a touch of sibling rivalry playing out. Some things never change. But what about the Levites? They were the priestly tribe, right? Responsible for the tabernacle, all the religious rituals. Did they get a chunk of land too?
The Levites were unique in that they didn't receive a specific tribal territory like the others. Instead, they were given 48 cities scattered throughout the land. So they had a presence among all the tribes.
Oh, that's interesting. So instead of having one concentrated area, they were spread out, almost like spiritual ambassadors embedded within each tribe.
Exactly. It was a brilliant way to integrate spiritual leadership and teaching into the fabric of Israelite society. Remember, the Levites, they were the keepers of the law, the teachers of the Torah. They were essential for preserving that covenant relationship with God.
It's like having a built-in religious education system. I hadn't thought of it that way before.
Yeah.
But, okay, what about the land that wasn't conquered? We talked about how some areas remained under Canaanite control.
Right. The conquest wasn't entirely complete. Some pockets of resistance remained, especially in the coastal plains with their strong fortifications and in the fertile Jezreel Valley. And those unconquered territories, they would pose ongoing challenges for the Israelites in the years to come.
So even in victory, there was still work to be done, battles to be fought, both literally and spiritually.
Exactly. Taking possession of the Promised Land, it wasn't just about military conquest. It was about fully embracing God's ways and establishing a society that honored him. And this is where we see another layer of meaning in the land division. Pay attention to how much emphasis is placed on the tribe of Judah.
You're right. Judah does seem to get a pretty significant portion of the land. Why is that?
It's not a coincidence. Remember, it's from the tribe of Judah that David, the greatest king of Israel, would eventually come, and ultimately the Messiah, Jesus himself.
Wow. I totally missed that connection. So even in these chapters that seem to be about, you know, boundaries and inheritance, there's this foreshadowing of what's to come, a hint of the messianic line that will eventually lead to Jesus. Okay, my mind is blown.
It's amazing how God works, right? He's always working behind the scenes, orchestrating events to fulfill his ultimate plan of redemption. But, you know, there's one theme that we keep coming back to throughout the book of Joshua, and that's obedience.
Obedience, yeah. It's like the key to everything, right? Yeah. Their success, their blessings, it's all tied to their willingness to follow God's commands.
Absolutely. We saw it in the conquest, and we see it again here in the land division. It's this constant reminder that their well-being, their very survival, depends on staying in right relationship with God. And it's not just about blind obedience either. It's about trusting God, recognizing that his ways are ultimately for their good, even when they don't understand.
And that's a tough lesson to learn, even for us today, right? We want to do things our way, but often that leads to problems, setbacks, all those things.
So true. We're all prone to wander off course, but the beauty of it is God never gives up on us. He's always there, ready to redirect us, to guide us back to the path that leads to life.
Which brings us back to Joshua, this amazing leader who guided the Israelites through this whole pivotal period.
Right.
What can we learn from his leadership? What made him so effective?
Joshua was a man of courage, a man of decisiveness. But above all, he had this unwavering faith in God. Remember those words God spoke to him after Moses' death. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. And those words, they became Joshua's guiding principle.
He never acted on his own. He always sought God's guidance. He consulted the priests. He reminded the people of God's faithfulness. He was more than just a military commander. He was a spiritual leader, constantly pointing people back to God.
And that's what made him so effective. True leadership. It's rooted in humility. It's rooted in dependence on God. And you see that in Joshua's commitment to covenant renewal. Conquering the land, that was just the first step. The real challenge was to build a society that honored God, that lived according to his laws. Mm-hmm. And we see that so clearly in the ceremony at Shechem between the mountains of blessing and cursing.
Yeah, that visual, it's so powerful. This reminder of the consequences of obedience and disobedience, it's hard to forget that.
It was a defining moment for the Israelites, a chance to reaffirm their commitment to the covenant and to choose who they would serve. And that choice, you know, that commitment to follow God, that's something we're still wrestling with today, isn't it?
Every single day. It's a daily decision to surrender our own will and to align ourselves with God's purposes. But okay, we've covered a lot of ground. We've talked about conquest, the land division, the importance of obedience, even hints of the Messiah. But there's still one more piece of the puzzle we need to explore. Joshua's farewell address. What does he say as he prepares to leave the Israelites? And how do they respond?
Those final words are crucial. They set the stage for what happens next in Israel's story.
Okay, now I'm on the edge of my seat. What does Joshua say? What challenges does he lay out for them? And how will they respond? We'll have to find out in the final part of our deep dive into the book of Joshua. All right, so we're back for the final part of our deep dive into the book of Joshua. We've gone through battles and campaigns, the division of the land, and now we're going to zoom in on this amazing leader, Joshua, as he prepares to say goodbye. It's like we've reached this pivotal moment in Israel's story. You know, you can feel the anticipation building as they prepare to move forward without their fearless leader. I'm curious, what made his leadership style so effective?
Well, just think about it. Imagine the weight on his shoulders leading this massive group of people. Most of them, they've only ever known life wandering in the wilderness. And now he's got to bring them into this new land, a land with its own challenges, potential conflicts. To pull that off, you need strength, you need decisiveness, and more than anything, you need an unshakable faith. And that's exactly what we see in Joshua, right?
It's like he was so completely confident, not in himself, but in God's promises. I mean, those words God gives him right after Moses dies. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. It's like a blueprint for leadership, even today.
It really is. And you see that principle, that reliance on God, all throughout his leadership. He's not just a military guy calling the shots. He's constantly seeking guidance, talking to the priests, reminding the people about God's faithfulness.
He never just jumps into action.
Yeah.
Always checking in with God before making any major move. It's impressive. It's like he's showing us what it means to be humble, to rely on something bigger than yourself. And speaking of reminding the people, there's that powerful scene at Shechem. The Israelites, they're gathered between those mountains, Ebal and Gerizim, representing blessings and curses, right? And Joshua was leading them in this ceremony of covenant renewal. It's a huge deal. Why was this so important?
Picture that scene. The Israelites all gathered there, and those mountains looming over them, representing the choices before them, the consequences. It's not just a symbolic gesture. It's a deliberate choice to recommit to God, to his laws. It's like Joshua saying, listen, we've won the battles, we've got the land, but the real battle, it's in our hearts. Are we going to choose to follow God, or are we going to go our own way?
It's like you're saying, winning the land is one thing, but building a society where God is honored, that's the real challenge. It's about building something that lasts, a legacy of faithfulness.
You got it. And that idea, that legacy, it leads us right into Joshua's farewell address, those final words to people before he dies. He's handing them the torch, trusting them to carry on the mission. What does he say to them? How does he prepare them for what's next?
It must have been an emotional moment. This leader who's been with them through so much, now saying goodbye, I'm ready to hear those words.
So he reminds them of everything, right? The escape from Egypt, the Red Sea parting, those years in the wilderness, and now this, conquering the promised land. All those incredible acts of God. And then he asks them a simple but really profound question. He says, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. He's like he's saying, you've seen God's power. You've experienced his faithfulness firsthand. Now it's up to you. Are you in or are you out?
That's a question that still resonates today, doesn't it? It's a choice we all have to make. Do we follow our own desires, or do we surrender to the God who offers true life, true freedom?
And that's what makes Joshua such a great leader. He doesn't just tell them what to do. He empowers them to decide for themselves. He's preparing them to live their faith, even when he's gone.
He's equipping them to face the future. And speaking of the future, as we move into the book of Judges, that's exactly what we're going to see. How did the Israelites fare without Joshua at the helm? Do they remember his words? Do they stay true to the covenant? Do they choose to follow God with their whole hearts?
That's the big question hanging over this next chapter. The book of Judges, it's full of highs and lows, stories of incredible faith, but also cautionary tales about what happens when people turn away from God.
Well, listeners, it sounds like we're in for a fascinating journey as we move into Judges. But for now, we're going to wrap up our deep dive into the book of Joshua. Thank you so much for joining us as we've explored this incredible story of faith, courage, and the enduring power of God's promises. Keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep diving deep.